Pressuring the authorities to act was something Escobedo had grown accustomed to. Speaking at a forum in October, the retired nurse said she couldn't give a single example of a case of a murdered young woman in Juarez that authorities have investigated on their own without pressure from victims' families. Unlike most of the city's so-called femicides, the identity of the killer was known in this case. That's because Marisela Escobedo carried out her own investigation. She didn't have to look far to find the killer. It was her son-in-law, Sergio Rafael Barraza, who had already displayed abusive and controlling tendencies before he beat 16-year-old Ruby to death, burned her remains, and disposed of them in a trash dump. What did take detective work was tracking him down after he fled Juarez with his infant daughter, Marisela Escobedo's granddaughter. But Escobedo did find him, and he was arrested and tried under a controversial new system known as oral trials.
El tribunal absuelve por unanimidad.
In April, a three-judge panel absolved the confessed killer over lack of evidence, despite his admission to having burned the evidence. The ruling provoked a gut-wrenching scene from the grieving mother who had spent her own time, energy, and limited resources performing work that, on paper, should have been done by professional police investigators. Escobedo was pulled screaming and crying from the courtroom, and her daughter's killer was set free. He's been missing ever since. But Escobedo kept fighting and shining the spotlight on the incompetence and irregularities that have become hallmarks of the investigations into the femicide cases. A group of attorneys was successful in overturning the ruling that absolved Barraza, and he was sentenced in absentia to 50 years in prison. Escobedo carried out a series of attention-grabbing moves to try to force police to track Barraza down and take him into custody. Just days before her murder, Marisela Escobedo confronted the Chihuahua state governor in public, saying justice was something the government meted out only for the privileged. Escobedo was gunned down literally in front of the government palace's main entrance, just minutes after the doors were closed for the night. The crime was caught on tape by security cameras, but no arrests have been made. This has prompted friends and family members to suggest Escobedo's murder may have been politically motivated. The government suggests Sergio Barraza is tied to the slaying. And the crimes didn't stop there. The night after Marisela Escobedo was gunned down while demanding justice for her daughter, the lumber store owned by her partner was burned to the ground by a group of armed men who also kidnapped her brother-in-law. A day later, her brother-in-law's body was found wrapped in a blanket with a plastic bag over his head. Investigators deny any link between the crimes. They're just two more in the over 30,000 deaths in Mexico in the past 4 years. Most of these crimes languish in the same impunity as the cases of the hundreds of young women murdered in Ciudad Juarez. For the Women's International News Gathering Service, I'm Shannon Young in Mexico.
Impunity for femicide is not limited to Mexico. Aboriginal women and their allies are demanding police accountability for hundreds of unsolved cases of missing and murdered Aboriginal women across Canada. In August 2010, the Vancouver Police Department apologized for having let a serial killer go free in 1997, 5 years before he was finally charged for 27 of what he himself said were 49 murders of women. After the apology, local residents felt police indifference to murders of poor and Native women continued. Mandavni Dami filed this report in October with the national community news program Groundwire.
Ashley Nicole Michiskinet, May 20th, 1987 to September 15th, 2010. She's from Kwakiutoss First Nation, and she was greatly loved and missed by our family and our nation.
Ashley Michiskinick was found dead behind the Regent Hotel in Vancouver's downtown east side on September 15, 2010. Ashley Michiskinick was a young Indigenous woman from Saskatchewan. The Vancouver police calls Ashley's death a suicide, but women residents and activists of the downtown east side are critical of the Vancouver Police Department's statement. Women activists and residents expressed these sentiments and responded to the police's statement at a press conference that was held on October 5th. Alice Kendall was one of these women.
Once again, the Vancouver police is demonstrating that when we're talking about women in this community, that they won't take it seriously.
Stella August also spoke.
It's not suicide. It is a murder case. And they say they're investigating, but I don't believe it because they didn't even seal the room off where she was thrown out of the window. So how can they say it's not murder? And how can they push it and say it's suicide?
So do you think the police is hiding something?
They cover up everything because it's an Aboriginal. They don't care. They don't give a damn. They just sweep everything under the carpet. That's why I'm out here. No more silence. No more lies and no more sweeping under the carpet.
On October 4th, 2010, residents of the downtown east side held a vigil at the Regent Hotel. This vigil was held in honor of Ashley Michiskinick and as part of a National Day of Action for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. The vigil was followed by a protest to demand police accountability. The protest was held outside of the Vancouver Police Department. As part of the demonstration, seven women entered the Vancouver Police Department. Three women were arrested.
We had sent a letter to Constable Chief Jim Chu asking for information about the investigation into the death of Ashley. And we gave him a deadline, and he did not meet the deadline. So we went to deliver the letter to him yesterday at the police department. And this is all on the heels of Doug Lepard's report, where, you know, we learned from the police about how they had bungled the investigations of the murders of women during the 90s. And this is also now with the backdrop of the public inquiry. We wanted to let them know with no uncertain terms that this is a new day in terms of how this community is going to respond to the police lack of involvement and lack of approach in investigating the murders and disappearances. So the question about why we think that it's not a suicide, because of the reports of witnesses, because of what people have told us. People have told us that she came out of the window and landed on the ground. 10 seconds later, her shoes went afterwards. We've also heard reports that there were people in the hotel that heard that she was being assaulted within the room, and they believe that was a sexual assault by more than one man. And law enforcement has made no attempt at this point to reach out to get witnesses. We've had two very high-profile incidences of violence against women in British Columbia recently, one in Pitt Meadows and one in Delta. And each time we had compelling police involvement, compelling visibility of police investigating. We have not seen anything like that in the disappearances and the murders in these communities. Nothing.
That was Angela Marie McDougall speaking on October 5th, the day after the arrests. Community members of Vancouver's downtown east side continue to demand police accountability and a change in their attitude towards the residents of the downtown east side.
The police down here have a responsibility to serve and protect every citizen of this city, not just people in Delta or people in Kitsilano. People down here have a right to investigations when they're victims of crime. That's a human right.
The Vancouver police did not respond to a request for an interview. This is Mandavni Thammi reporting for Groundwire.
Another kind of serial killer is unsafe, illegal abortion. Jerry Adams is with UN Radio's program Women.
An estimated 36,000 women die annually from unsafe abortions in Africa. Many of them are young girls who have unwanted pregnancies and who are forced to have abortions illegally.
A large percentage of the unsafe abortions are basically the young women with school-going age who don't want to drop out of school.
Abortion is, in most cases, illegal in Africa, but there are moves to legalize it. Thoko Ruzvidzo is from the UN's Economic Commission for Africa. Her focus at the Center for Gender and Social Development is to push for legalization.
It's not legal. A lot of it is not legal because here you're talking about cultural beliefs and religion. To a great extent, religion.
What happens when young girls have unwanted pregnancies?
The typical scenario is young girls who are still at school, we've had unprotected sex and are pregnant and want to continue with schooling. In most instances, they will go for unsafe abortion, which means, you know, they'll find somebody who can do it quietly by doctors illegally or by non-trained practitioners. But in most instances, it's non-trained practitioners using all different ways of aborting, which are not necessarily safe, nor are they hygienic. There's been a lot of work by gender activists, and that's the reason why we are doing the work that we are doing and get member states to legalize abortion. Let me give you a few examples that have put in place policies, but not necessarily legalized. There's ongoing work in Nigeria, Ghana, Zambia. South Africa and Ethiopia are, you know, there's a bit of leverage on working on abortion. But to a great extent, a lot of abortion is restricted within the laws. It will require a major shift. You have to look at the religious convictions. You have to look at the, you know, the whole taboo around abortion. So you find there is a lot of resistance, so it will take a lot of time. I don't want to say it will not happen. There are all sorts of legal frameworks that have been put in place addressing women's rights, which we never thought would happen. But it will take a long time because you have to look at the change of attitude.
Thoko Ruzvidzo of the UN Economic Commission for Africa.
That was Jerry Adams of UN Radio's program Women. Daniel Dickinson conducted the original interview. UN Radio has just announced that the Women program will be shortened from 14 minutes to 10 minutes a week. You can find the weekly show and contact info at radio.un.org. Who makes the news? That question is the title of the Global Media Monitoring Project's 2010 report. Headquartered in Canada, the GMMP periodically checks progress on media coverage of women around the world. Kathy Cross, a communications lecturer at Simon Fraser University, is one of its researchers and authors.
From 1995, there has been every 5 years a review of how the news represents women and how many women are in the news. And now in 2010, we actually have the fourth study. This time we had 108 countries involved, which represents about 82% of the world's population. And we monitored news for 1 day across the world.
Volunteers in many countries and regions took down the data on November 10, 2009. They coded their results and sent it to headquarters to be collated, analyzed, and written up over the next 10 months. Dr. Cross wrote up both the Canadian National Report and the North American Report, which includes the U.S. She compares those results to the international picture.
Overall, globally, the representation of women in the news is 24% compared to 76% for men. And that is up from 17% 15 years ago. So globally, we're making some progress towards parity, although someone quipped the other day, at this rate, we'll reach gender parity in the news in 40 years. So it's glacially slow. What's interesting is that we're not making any progress in North America. We're actually fairly stalled. In 1995, we had 27% women in the news, and in 2010, we have 28% women in the news. So there's very, very little movement.
1 percentage point increase in news coverage of women over 15 years sounds like a little progress, but what's the content of that increase in our region?
More general news about celebrities than there was 15 years ago. That is one of the areas where women are represented in the news more often as mothers and performers. Those are the conventional roles that women show up in. And the only reason we've had any increase at all is because of the increase of celebrity news.
One other traditional portrayal of women in the news is as victims. Dr. Kathy Cross.
Globally, women are in the news more than twice as likely as men to be portrayed as victims. So internationally, 18% of the women in the news were victims, where 8% of the men in the news were victims. When it comes to North American news, we're not sure if it's statistically relevant. But when it comes to experts, both in terms of Canada and North America and internationally, the number of people who are identified as experts in areas of politics or even areas where women outnumber men, still the representation was still dominantly male. So, for example, law, people who are legal experts, the percentage that were women was about 9% compared to the fact that women who actually have law degrees in Canada are close to 50%.
Dr. Cross says that North America has tended to be about 5 to 10% ahead of the rest of the world in including women in its news. But the rest of the world is now starting to catch up. Canada is still doing better than the U.S., but according to Cross, the greatest factor in that is the comparatively good gender balance of coverage on the CBC. You can read all the reports of the Global Media Monitoring Project and even watch videos about it on the website whomakesthenews.org. The last story in today's program comes from the United Kingdom. Their young people have been arrested en masse for protesting austerity measures that foreclose their futures. Bonnie Soans of Women's Parliamentary Radio interviewed two young women who were sitting in at Cambridge University to protest recent 100% tuition hikes announced at the end of November. Increases amounting to thousands of pounds per year were passed by the recently elected Conservative government with help from coalition partners in the Liberal Democrat Party.
Polly and Rachel, thank you very much indeed for talking to Women's Parliamentary Radio today. We're sitting in the old schools at Cambridge University. This is indeed the student sit-in, the protest against the rise in tuition fees. Tell me a little bit about how you feel students have been treated by the current coalition government.
Well, I feel they've been completely ignored, and they've also been patronised. Nick Clegg's most recent statement about student protesters putting other people off is absurd. It suggests we can't all download the Brown Review and understand exactly what's going on and understand these cuts are going to be devastating to the future of our higher education.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're seeing here is a generation that are going to be massively disillusioned with their politicians, people who should be leading them and looking after their future are betraying them. And a lot of the students that have been coming out to protest don't actually have the vote yet. They're 15, 16, 17, and for them, protest is the only way to make their voice heard, and it's essential that they are making their voice heard because it's their futures that are at stake. So I think at the moment what we're seeing is a lot of betrayal of students, and that is where this student action is coming from.
That strong language, and indeed there have been strong protests. We've just looked at the Cambridge Evening News, where your local Liberal Democrat MP, Julian Huppert, newly elected this year in the general election, has told you all to rethink, has said that he thinks that, you know, university funding is in crisis. This solution is a good one.
Privatisation of higher education is not a good solution, and that's what we're looking at here. I think Julian Huppert's behaviour is symptomatic of the Liberal Democrat Party in general. You can't trust them, and I don't anymore.
Yes, I agree. And I think that despite Huppert saying that he is going to keep to his pledge on not raising tuition fees, actually he's doing the bare minimum, and it's a complete election ploy. So what he's said is that he will abstain from the vote, but when I spoke to him after a protest, he said he was very proud of his party and what they were doing. He's doing the bare minimum in order to keep his seat with the agreement of the rest of his party, and his actions are actually propping up the coalition government that will allow these higher tuition fees to go through. So what we're seeing is a politician who's very adept at lying and obfuscating the truth, and is attempting to do that in order to keep the student vote.
Some students, the Conservative students group in Cambridge, are actually supporting the new agreement and actually are supporting Julian.
Is that surprising that the Conservative students are supporting the Conservative government? We don't think so, but we would add that they are a small minority of students, and what we've really seen here is a massive amount of support for the occupation that's happened. Nearly 300 academics have signed up to support the occupation. Our student union, QSU, has signed up to support it. Countless college unions have also decided to support it, and we've had a lot of support from the rest of the town. So I don't think you can take the actions of a small conservative and frankly reactionary minority who are of course going to support their party line as representative of the student body here. And the other point I was going to make about Harper is, you know, luckily for us, students aren't as stupid as he thinks they are, and I don't think he's going to get away with what he's doing. I think that in the next election he will lose because of his actions and because of his party's actions.
Polly, we're sitting at Cambridge University. It's very global these days. Students from all over the world came, India, China, but particularly the United States. And there they too pay so much more for their education. Some would say that actually university education in Britain has been too cheap for too long. What do you say to those critics?
I say I find it fascinating that our international petition currently has over 800 academic signatures, and or not just academics, but signatures, some of whom are significant American academics. We have Professor Drusilla Cornell, Noam Chomsky, you know, a whole number of people who are in these academies in America who see what's happened to their system and want desperately for this not to happen to our English system. And we also hear reports from American students, you know, just rallying with us to say, don't let what's happened to us happen to you. You know, we have a fight on our hands and we have an obligation to fight it well.
And Polly, what about you? You know, the fees being doubled from 3,000 to 6,000 and then maybe 9,000 or no cap at all.
What do I think of that? Well, of course, I think it's disgraceful. And in our occupation, we have decided that we should be fighting for free education for all, that education should be a right and not predicated on your ability to pay. And so it's not about it's been too cheap for too long. It should never have been predicated on your ability to pay. Our parents' generation benefited from free education, and we feel that that's possible in this society too. And we also feel that the cuts that they say are motivating this drive to a higher tuition fee and less government funding for education, we feel that those cuts are ideologically motivated, that the rhetoric of necessity is actually a smokescreen for the real ideological motivation behind the condemned cuts. When you think about who they're deciding to affect when they're making these cuts, you can really see that division. So the banks were bailed out to £850 billion. Corporation tax has been lowered recently. You're seeing corporations like Vodafone evading a £6 billion tax bill, and yet they're telling ordinary people that we can no longer afford opportunity for all and an education system that's open for all.
If we cast our mind back, say, to April 2010, just before you were about to choose who to vote for at the May election, Labour for another fourth term, Conservatives, Liberal Democrats, whether you cast your vote at home or here in Cambridge, how did you make that decision?
Well, it was very tough because at the time I felt like we were getting lots of promises of a new politics, and I was inclined to be cynical of that from the start. And I think what's happened subsequently has absolutely cashed out on that cynicism. You know, nothing has changed. In fact, if anything, it's changed for the worse. I mean, I'm happy to talk about how I voted because...
How did you vote?
I actually voted Green in this election. I feel that I was suspicious of Julian Harper, and I feel quite smug about that. The Labour government betrayed students with the first introduction of the top-up fees, and there were various issues such as ID cards in the Iraq War, which I absolutely refused to put my name next to. And I'm never going to vote Conservative because I think we've seen exactly what happens when you let the Conservatives into power.
Absolutely. I think that Polly said it all. We are part of a generation that has been systematically betrayed by politicians from all parties. One of the first political actions I ever took at the age of 15 was to walk out of school against the Iraq War. Now a million people marched against the Iraq War. There was widespread dissent, and yet the politicians ignored us. And what we're seeing here with the cuts and the tuition fees pledges is a very similar betrayal. So I think this doesn't give young people, or people anywhere in fact, not just young people, any trust in our political systems. And I actually think our political systems are failing us. And that's when we need to ask ourselves, do we have a democratic deficit in this country? And I think the answer to that is yes, we do. There's no opportunity for redress against these politicians who are breaking their promises. And so I think that what we're seeing here with waves of civil disobedience, protests, is absolutely necessary to the functioning of our society, to correct what we've seen here, to correct the absolute disregard for any democratic voice. And when big business and corporations and the rich have the ear of government, these kind of cuts that affect ordinary people everywhere are going to happen.
Now, British politics generally is in disrepute, or has been, because of the so-called MPs' expenses scandal, which hit all MPs equally, really, across all parties, Labour, Conservative and Liberal Democrat. You talked about student tuition fees being a democratic betrayal. Do you think it's a bigger betrayal or as big as MPs' expenses? Polly?
I mean, I think it's a bigger betrayal. You know, the fact is, I felt like the expenses scandal was something of, it was systematic and it was evidence of corruption within Westminster. This is evidence of the fact that our government is willing to put in jeopardy the futures of the people it's supposed to be representing. I mean, that is just such a widespread problem and, it's just unacceptable.
I mean, what I felt with the expenses scandal, which obviously ran and ran and ran in the media as a story, is that actually it was a distraction from some of the real problems that we're facing. I do think that betrayal of politicians was bad, but it was symptomatic of wider problems within our system and of wider lack of accountability by politicians. And I think that the fact that the newspapers focused on that issue for so long is a major betrayal, and yet they're not looking at things like tuition fee rises, education cuts, and wider cuts to our public sectors, is actually kind of shows the way that the media are trying to frame the cuts at the moment. We've seen both Rupert Murdoch and the head of the BBC go in for private talks with David Cameron to talk about how to frame the cuts. And so I don't really even trust the media to portray this well either, actually. And I think we're really going to have to do it for ourselves here.
Thank you for letting us share your occupation of the combination rooms. Rachel, your badge says trespassing and proud of it. I must be trespassing too. So Women's Parliamentary Radio must be on our way. Polly, Rachel, thank you.
Wings thanks all today's contributors and our supporters, including WORT-FM, Madison, Wisconsin, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, subject of the film Giving for Giving, which you can view on YouTube. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Lee Bonner's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Bismillah, like the feeling when I miss Falah, then wish to God and clouds to lift us all. Alhamdulillah, I wonder if BB can ever see me, and if I go back to Basra, will it ever receive me? Bismillah, homies that have the time to talk, now I wish for stars that angels find a wharf. Alhamdulillah, I stand ordered the strength of my sister, kiss her and thank God our mission is planned for. Bismillah, mamati, inti hayati, mom the best one, hold her close to heart like my left. Alhamdulillah, for the truth and the being is beaming as the moon queen, you bless my future to be with. Bismillah, for the soul's anguish, love, and the moment my brothers program these drums. Alhamdulillah, we put the truth to the test, proof that we bless students of this music at best. It goes. Way before militants try to split this law. Alhamdulillah, every living day that we spent in the rays of the shams while we praise the condemned. Bismillah, wish I could take it back and lift the harm, make a track, erase the past that we missing. Alhamdulillah, we spoke so right, we listened wrong, living raw more than a living song. Give it all. Bismillah, so I don't rely on an image or man-made divisions for land, slave, prison, Alhamdulillah, excuse me if I use it loosely, forget to bow down and pray. How proud are they? Hope you hear the whispers, then ask which stance should I sway, betray my whisper. Alhamdulillah, forever hope this lasts, and we lift class. Without a ball and a chain, a slave falling in flames. Bismillah, we're forever holding the peace. With the streets, crippled little beans, dribbling through the Middle East. Alhamdulillah, may God bless the dead and gone. Forever strong, a better song, breaking bitter bonds. Alhamdulillah, for this world and this spot to this song. With these words for hip hop, say alhamdulillah. Stay humble and rhymes for eyes, hate your hunger. It's like a jungle sometimes that makes you wonder.